I started with an analyst probably right as I was ending residency and starting the fellowship in behavioral neurology and movement disorders. So it was right in this transition time. And over time, it transitioned into a psychoanalysis. And I think it served a number of functions. I mean, there was something about the way of exploring what was going on, trying to get to the bottom of it, trying to understand it, trying to understand oneself with another person that I think like was closer to what I was trying to get to originally. And there was also something about him, my analyst, that seemed so, what word I want to use? Like the first word that came up was calm, but it's not quite calm, but something about like just like satisfied or something like that, that I thought that I was kind of missing. Like what I was doing was good. And, you know, we can all work hard and do a lot of things. Like there's a lot of things you could do, but like somehow the fit wasn't right. Like I was forcing a fit of some kind or trying to turn something into something that would be a better fit and working pretty hard at that, if that makes any sense. So there was like something about his way that made me feel like maybe I could feel like that in my career.
I went to therapy because I felt that I need help. And it was like with a psychoanalyst, and we met twice, like for two sessions a week. So it wasn't psychoanalysis yet. And the thing that I found most exciting with him, it was that it's like a different kind of thinking. You know, I remember like sitting in the sessions and thinking that he's thinking totally different from me, and that it's so exciting, so overwhelming, a little frightening, but something that, you know, I felt an inclination to think like that. So I remember like in one of the sessions, I had like the image of memory as like beads on a line. And I understood that he doesn't think like that. But for him, memory fragments are like a conglomerate of beads together, like grapes together. So it's not linear. And I was really amazed by this and excited by this. And during the years, when I really started the analysis with, actually, I'm still in analysis, and I understood, or I found out that like this kind of thinking is really, really, really can be influential, can make a change in my life as a patient or my life as a therapist.
Welcome to the Psychoanalysis On and Off the Couch podcast. For the past few years, we've been speaking with analysts from around the world who've been applying their analytic way of thinking not only to their offices, but also off the couch in venues external to their consulting rooms. We've spoken to analysts who work in hospitals, in prisons, in community health centers, in refugee clinics, just to name a few. We've also detoured, of course, during COVID. We've spoken with analysts again from around the world to learn from our communities how they, their patients, and the analytic community in general have been dealing with this crisis. And hopefully, the worst is over, and we can return to our main focus. We can return to speaking to analysts who are bringing their skills to people who otherwise would never see the inside of an analyst's office. In addition to that, we're speaking with the elders of our field, people who have been practicing this craft for 40 and 50, sometimes longer years, to learn from them what they have to teach us, not only about this piece of history that we're all living through, but their reflections on our field. Please visit us at our website, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can leave a comment, where you can subscribe. I hope you find these conversations thoughtful and meaningful. And I appreciate your listening. Thank you. Welcome to today's podcast. I'm Harvey Schwartz, and my two guests today are Iftah Biran and Rachel Gross. And what they have in common is that they had been neurologists. They trained as neurologists. They actually ended up training in the same program, though a few years apart, in behavioral neurology for fellowship training. And from there, they sought what was true to their heart and their mind was to become psychoanalysts. And they walk us through this journey of theirs. And they share many other things as well. They share the advantages and burdens, perhaps is the way to characterize it, of having two ways of thinking of things as an analyst and as a physician neurologist. And they describe how that is challenging at times. And they also both bring their clinical analytic skills back to the world of neurology in terms of providing balance type groups for neurology trainees to give neurologists what they themselves have discovered as analysts, a freedom to think and to feel and to speak, a freedom that was lacking in their earlier careers. Iftar Biran is also a psychiatrist, and he maintains his subspecialty in behavioral neurology. He is a recent graduate of the Israeli Psychoanalytic Association. He's in private practice, and he's also working in the Department of Neurology at the Tel Aviv Medical Center as a liaison psychiatrist and neuropsychiatrist. He is also the co-editor of the journal Neuropsychoanalysis, and he is completing a bachelor degree in philosophy and literature at the Open University of Israel. Rachel Gross, as I mentioned, was a neurologist and also trained as a behavioral neurologist. She also became the co-director of training for neurology at the University of Pennsylvania. She now has a private practice in Philadelphia where she provides psychotherapy, analysis, and medication management. She is a sought-after teacher and clinician, and she, as I mentioned, facilitates a group to support the emotional well-being of the neurology residents at the University of Pennsylvania. Their journeys, though on different continents, have a great deal in common. We also discuss the formative aspects of their own personal treatments. And I learned a lot, and I find it fascinating as we get to know analysts and their journeys from around the IPA world, how much we share and also what we bring that's unique. So here is my conversation. I hope you enjoy it with Iftar Biran and Rachel Gross. Welcome to the podcast, Iftar and Rachel. It's so good to have you both here. We've been learning about the many paths to becoming a psychoanalyst. Recently, I interviewed Susanna Merlo and Ellen Pinsky from Argentina and the U.S. about their journey from the world of education to the training to become a psychoanalyst. But there are many, many paths, and today we're going to talk about what it's like to train as a neurologist and then to make the journey to switch to becoming a psychoanalyst. Now, Rachel, I knew of your journey because you and I are both in Philadelphia, but I had to ask around to find someone who had a similar experience, and I was given the name of Iftar in Tel Aviv. And I thought these journeys would be very unique, but in fact, when the three of us first met, it turns out that you both had trained in behavioral neurology at a fellowship not far from here in Philadelphia, though you weren't there at the same time. And another similarity is that you're both involved not only now practicing as analysts, but also in working with balance type groups for your colleagues back in neurology. And we're going to talk about those posts of life, those clinical enterprises that you've done that are similar. But let's start, Iftar, alphabetically. If you would walk us through what your life was like that led you to medicine, that led you to neurology and behavioral neurology. And then I'll ask you to pause there, and then Rachel will share her story. And then we'll talk about what behavioral neurology is and why perhaps it's not surprising that you both stopped there on your way to train as a full analyst. Iftar, you want to start us off?
Okay. So I think that becoming an analyst was some kind of a closure of a long, long trip and a long split that I found after on the you know, when I was wondering what I was going to do as an adult. So I was really in back in my 20s, I was thinking of studying either comparative literature or medicine. So it was like the influence of my mother, which was a physician, and I was really a very, very interested in reading, in understanding the world through literature. And I thought that medicine can be a good humanistic choice, that it would be something that can bring together what I found in literature, understanding people, looking at them closely, and trying to decipher their whatever they suffer from or whatever they're doing. And then that's actually why I went into neurology, because I thought that it's going to shed some more light on this, and into behavioral neurology, which I thought that it's really like very humane discipline where you really concentrate on a single patient. This is what I did as a behavioral neurologist. So I thought it's really understanding the suffering of a single human being in a very detailed form. And when I did my behavioral neurology fellowship, it was a little still toward the experimental psychology side, where you look at where you really don't pay much attention to the psychic side of the patient. And I found this lacking. That's why I went into, as a behavioral neurologist in our hospital, I entered the psychotherapeutic school at the institute where I did my psychoanalytic training.
Let me ask you something about that. You said the focus on the individual in behavioral neurology didn't focus on the emotional side. Did I hear you right? What did you focus on?
No. So it was mainly, you know, understanding like the mechanistic causality, the mechanistic side of the behavior. So actually, like I spent almost half a year on a patient with alien hand syndrome. You know, there were like 2, 3, 4 papers devoted to him, something like that. And then I found out that I, aside from asking him, good morning, how do you feel today? I didn't really try to understand like what it is to being like with an alien hand. How do you feel it? What's the, really the experience, the inner experience? And I really wanted to add this into my practice. And so that's why I went to to school of psychotherapy, and then I started doing I did a residency in psychiatry, and then I entered the psychoanalytic school. So,
you know, when you describe that, working so long with a patient with this quite dramatic neurologic condition, and never engaging him on what his experience is, I literally got chills up my back. I can't fathom what that's like. As fascinating as the neurology must have been, and I don't doubt that for a minute, what it must take for you to alienate yourself from the experience to deal with him in such an alienated way. It's a very very captivating picture that you've presented.
Yeah, I feel when I tell this story, I feel a little uncomfortable with it.
Yeah, I can imagine.
A little ashamed in myself that I was like that back then, and I'm trying to be a little different now.
Mm-hmm. But you make note of your mother was a physician, and that you've indicated has played an important part in your pursuing this route, yes?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I grew like in a typical son of a mother physician who's engaged with patients, and she was really a very empathic person. She was really like into understanding her patients and looking at them. You know, it was like, although I grew up in Jerusalem, and it's like not a small town. It was back then like 500,000 people there, and She was like a small village physician.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a common past I've run into. Rachel, tell us your backstory.
Okay, sure. each time I listen to you go through this IFT, I just am amazed at how many pieces are similar. It's like there's something that started, something I was looking for at the very beginning, and it never really changed. It just took a number of stages to kind of get closer and closer to the thing that I was looking for, sort of like you described. And I think the roots of some of it, you know, started with like if I had to snapshot some interactions with each of my parents, you know, like that stand out as feeling connected to them, related to them, it would be these two things. And it would be that my mother each night would spend, I guess it was 20 minutes with each of us, my sister and me. And the whole point of it was just to kind of like talk about what was ever on our mind at that time before bed. And it sort of created this like interest in, you know, what goes on in your mind. And it was just like her sole attention right before going to sleep. And then my father, who is a physician, he's an internist. It's a different kind of interaction, I guess, but he loved literature. He loved language. And like one of our things was, you know, like he'd teach me new words and like talk about grammar. And I guess that sounds maybe boring to some kids, but I just kind of loved it. I loved how like the different words had different connotations and like you could change things up and change the meaning of things. And you could get very, very obsessional about the grammar. And I found the whole thing pretty fun and a way to connect with him. So I'd say with that in mind, I went to college and decided to major in linguistics. And doing that, you know, you'd spend all of this time kind of pouring through different aspects of language, the sounds, the syntax, the discourse, in all different kinds of languages, trying to understand how human language is structured in general. And I guess from there, I started to get interested in like, well, how does the brain do that? You know, that's pretty incredible. How do we acquire language? How do we use it to convey meaning? How do we move from thought to talking to somebody else? And so I started taking courses in the psychology department related to that. So I guess after college, I worked for a year at Moss Rehab, which has like a research arm, and they studied aphasia. And there would be patients who had had strokes who had an expressive aphasia, let's say. And sort of as IFTA is talking about, we would do these like fine-grained analyses of the speech samples of people with aphasia, trying to like, you know, I would spend hours transcribing their speech, listening to them talk, asking them questions and transcribing their speech and trying to see like what in the context, like the phonological context might have prompted the error in the speech that was made, like what made like an M replace an R, for example, right? And it was the same kind of thing, like sitting in there doing that kind of work and like really wanting to know more about how it felt to be a person who could not express themselves. So one of the people that stands out was a preacher, very charismatic preacher, who would say, like, why, if I was called to speak, to preach, would God have taken away my ability to speak? You know, and there was a dentist who all he could say was, oh, dear, or I love you. Those were the only things he could say, like these highly repeated sorts of things. So no matter what you asked him, he would say those things and then tears would like kind of run down.
Oh.
And so I guess I just kind of found myself more drawn to talking to them and understanding more about what this was like for them. And I think it was in that setting that I thought going to medical school and becoming a neurologist would allow me to be with patients in that way, as opposed to like continuing down maybe some PhD linguistics, psycholinguistics kind of route. And then I guess I'll say that in doing so, you know how like your parent has a neighbor who has a friend who's, you know, who was a cognitive neurologist. And so then I got the chance to shadow this person who's at Penn and got to see what it was like working with people who have dementia. And I guess I saw this long-standing relationship and this person that was working with somebody as they lost, I guess, some of the most fundamental parts of being a human: language, memory, ability to process feelings, you know, losing empathy, this kind of motivation, things like this. And so I decided to go to medical school to become a cognitive neurologist. Like, that was the plan. And so I went through residency at Penn and did get interested in movement disorders also, where there are a lot of cognitive and behavioral psychiatric type problems that come up. So I did a joint fellowship at Penn in behavioral neurology and movement disorders. And then ultimately specialized in this kind of crossover of people that had Parkinsonism and dementia.
So it sounds like, tell me if I have this right, that you both pursued behavioral neurology sort of because you wanted to become psychoanalyst. You just didn't know it clearly at the time.
That's
right. Is that a fair?
Yeah.
Behavioral neurology, Iftah, you had mentioned that is a fascinating field with a notable history. Can you share that with us?
Okay. So actually, it's going back to the list of the books and papers that I sent you. So I'm really like into all this like historic thinking of the 19th century and the really the tradition of the neurologists of the 19th century who really did amazing things, and some of them were like forgotten during the years and only like re-emerged in the 17th, I think, with Norman Geschwind and Heilmann and his students. So behavioral neurology for me is like something that is really looking into the depth of the machinery of the brain. And I mean, this is the way it was practiced. And I believe now that it's also looking at the psychological machinery of the patient. I believe now it's practiced with a little more holistic approach. So for me, it was like the most humane part of the medicine.
And Luria plays a part in its origins, yes?
Yeah, of course.
Tell that story.
I mean, I'm always amazed. So Luria was actually, he began as a psychoanalyst. He actually created the Kazan Psychoanalytical Institute in the early, like before the end of the First World War. And then following the revolution in Russia, he understood that it's better to be a cognitive psychologist. And his works are really, I mean, all his papers and what he was doing is really, in a sense, with a psychoanalytical flavor. Hmm.
And he's one of the founders of behavioral neurology? Would that be a fair statement?
I think so, or neuropsychology or cognitive neuropsychology.
Right. Got it. Now, you both have described having been influenced by your own personal treatments. Tell me if I'm representing you correctly, that both of those experiences, as it does for many of us, of course, expose you to layers of being, new ways of understanding oneself and the people in one's life, and that played a formative part in your coming up with some version of, I want to do that. Is that fair? Rachel, you want to start us with that?
Yeah, sure. It's definitely fair. Let's see. I started with an analyst probably right as I was ending residency and starting the fellowship in behavioral neurology and movement disorders. Mm-hmm. It was right in this transition time. And, you know, over time it transitioned into a psychoanalysis. And I think it served a number of functions. I mean, there was something about the way of exploring what was going on, trying to get to the bottom of it, trying to understand it, trying to understand oneself with another person that I think like was closer to what I was trying to get to originally. And there was also something about him, my analyst, that seemed so, what word I want to use? Like the first word that came up was calm, but it's not quite calm, but something about like just like satisfied or something like that, that I thought that I was kind of missing in like what I was doing was good. And, you know, we can all work hard and do a lot of things. Like there's a lot of things you could do, but like somehow the fit wasn't right. Like I was forcing a fit of some kind or trying to turn something into something that would be a better fit and working pretty hard at that, if that makes any sense. So there's like something about his way that made me feel like maybe I could feel like that in my career. And, you know, and then I think like, as I realized, kind of like Ifta was saying, that there were aspects missing from being a neurologist that I wanted in my career and in my life, I wanted to go back and learn how to become a psychotherapist. And there's many ways one could do that, right? You could, you know, but I think because of my treatment and how powerful it was and how much it was, I was enjoying it in a lot of ways, finding it really interesting also, you know, that seemed like, okay, well, this is the way I'd like to go about becoming a psychotherapist. Right. Not one of the other paths I could have taken. This is the kind of psychotherapist. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Now, you're specifying psychotherapist as distinct from psychoanalyst?
Well, I guess what I meant by that was like I'd have to start retraining somehow.
Right.
Right? So how was I going to kind of go about doing that? And that's actually how I knew that psychoanalysis was a thing. Was because I was in one.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so when I got online and looked at, you know, our institute in Philadelphia, I saw that there actually was a pathway for people to train in psychoanalysis who had not been psychiatrists, psychologists, or social mm-hmm. workers.
Mm-hmm. Ifta, want to share with us what it was like for you?
Yeah, okay. So it's another interesting similarity because I also start my first therapy was like towards the end of my residency in neurology, the same like you, Rachel.
Uh-huh.
And it's interesting what causes this. And so it was like, I went to therapy because I thought that I need help. And it was like with a psychoanalyst, and we met twice, like for two sessions a week. So it wasn't psychoanalysis yet. And the thing that I found most exciting with him, it was that it's like a different kind of thinking. You know, I had like, I remember like sitting in the sessions and thinking that he's thinking totally different from me, and that it's so exciting, so overwhelming, a little frightening, but something that, you know, I felt an inclination to think like that. So I remember like in one of the sessions, I had like the image of memory as like beads on a line, on a line. And I understood that he doesn't think like that. But for him, memory fragments are like something like a conglomerate of beads together, like grapes together. So it's not linear. And I was really amazed by this and excited by this. And during the years, when I really started an analysis with, actually I'm still in analysis, and I understood, or I found out that like this kind of thinking is really, really, really can be influential, can be, can make a change in my life as a patient or my life as a therapist.
What's such, brings a smile to my face as I hear both of you, because I mean, analysis is many things, obviously, to many different people. And at different times, it's different things. And we all know that. But when sharing it, you both bring a delight to your experience. I mean, you both make clear that, among many other things, it was pleasurable and fascinating, as it is at its best. And it isn't that often that one gets a chance to actually talk to people about what their analytic experience is like. So thank you both for sharing that. That's wonderful. So just to switch back, so you're in behavioral neurology. You're not yet doing this thing that you both so beautifully just described. How did you make the switch? Rachel, you found a way to go the route of a psychotherapist. Iftar, you then went back, do I have the sequence right, to train as a psychiatrist?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And when you did make this leap, which is quite a leap, was it instantly, yes, here I am and I belong here and at long last I have found it? Or was it, of course, our imaginings are never the same as what it really is. What was it like for you, Iftar, when you first started your psychiatric training?
So I felt that it's not, I mean, you can look at it as a leap or a dichotomous change. And mm-hmm. I had the feeling maybe I'm like a little deceiving myself, but I still have this feeling that I'm actually now, like as a psychiatrist, psychoanalyst, I'm actually doing a very similar work to what I did as a behavioral neurology, but in a very different fashion. And I believe that in a better way. And so I did. So when I started doing a psychiatric residency, it's hard to go back to training, doing on-calls again.
Yeah, sure.
And things like that. But I was really, I thought that, you know, then it was like the best option to study what I wanted to study. And so I had to devote the time, energy, and suffering for that.
And Rachel, you was it that dramatic? Now, you didn't go the straight psychiatry route. You did the psychotherapy changeover.
I can explain that. I think here's a place where we're a little different, I think. Like, I have found these two things to be more separate. Like, I kind of had, in a certain way, to give up neurology in order to make this change. I mean, that's not 100% give up, because as I think we're going to talk about, it's like carried mm-hmm. with me all the time. But I think because either just like the way I handle competing things, or also just the way medicine is structured here, or at least the institution where I was is structured, it kind of required a giving up of one thing for another. And that was hard. I mean, that took me a while to like decide and then make the move. I thought also about going back to residency in psychiatry. And sometimes I wish that I had. And the rationale at the time was that what I was trying to learn was how to be like an excellent psychotherapist, psychoanalyst, and not necessarily as much about managing medications or like emergency mm-hmm. situations in psychiatry. And it was so heavily weighted toward those things in some of the psychiatry programs around here that I wasn't actually sure I would get what I was trying to get going that way. I will say that, you know, like at this point, I'm now, you know, in my mid to late 30s, I have a 2-year-old and an infant, and, you know, like going back to residency, like it wasn't all that appealing. So I'm sure that that played a role too. But I actually was very lucky to get an opportunity to kind of be an unofficial sort of psychology intern and postdoc at Pennsylvania Hospital with psychologists who were doing their training, and they were all affiliated with the Psychoanalytic Center, and their supervisors were psychoanalysts. And so I was given the opportunity to learn with them. So I spent a couple of years doing that, and at the same time started at the Psychoanalytic Center in Philadelphia. And after a few years, I was able to obtain a waiver. I had to get a waiver to start seeing control cases because I had not been a psychiatrist.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then you started both analytic training. Now, everything both has satisfactions and frustrations and disappointments. Iftar, what did you find analytic training to be, especially given that you weren't a regular candidate in that you had this whole other career and expertise and way of thinking as a neurologist? What was it like for you when you did your analytic training?
One thing is that I found that it's a place that really cherishes knowledge and thinking and looking at questions that you don't really have answers for. And I found it really stimulating, just, you know, going back and reading things, trying to understand, being able to reread them and understanding them differently, and then looking at it in a different way. So for me, it's something that I like, from my childhood, like reading. And so, it was an exciting thing. It's something that I got, I think, from both of my parents. They actually started as teachers originally.
I see.
My father was supposed to be a teacher for history and philosophy and Bible, biblical studies. And then from like circumstances back in the 50s in Israel, they had to go to university again. And they couldn't practice being a teacher. And then they did whatever they did for their career. But they were like, my mother is dead, my father is still alive, but they're really very curious persons. And the training really enabled this curiosity to... It was a place where you didn't have to apologize for being curious.
Oh, what a beautiful way to say it. Right. Rachel, what was training like for you?
So it's interesting. When I made the switch, I actually sort of crossed them. So while I was still working as a neurologist, I came to this psychoanalytic center to... It started as like an academic candidate to take classes and just see how it would feel to be there and learn that material and, hear other people's clinical material and things like this. And it's funny. It felt at first like a bit of a culture shock, to be honest, like sort of like, Rachel, you're not in neurology anymore, you know, like from the Wizard of Oz or something, like we're not in Kansas anymore. So, you know, there did seem to be like a new language I had to learn in a sense. And there was, I think what you make me think of, Ifta, is that there was something very freeing, something that felt so much freer than my experience in neurology, meaning like people were interested in those of us that had some kind of different background. Like that was a cool thing. That was an asset. That was something to be curious and interested in, as opposed to, you know, why don't you want to kind of be an academic physician scientist in sort of the same way? And then there were the way people were curious with each other, the way people shared their clinical material, the way people shared their own feelings about their clinical material was like, wow, I can't believe what these people are saying out loud. And so I found it very, very fun, very freeing. Sort of stepping in like that helped me decide that I was going to make the switch.
I want to add something that, like, our class in the institute where I was trained are very intimate. It's like a group of 10. So it's really something that helped me, like, the companionship.
Me too.
Which was very important. So, I mean, it's like the interaction was very good. And in a way, I think that, you know, I don't know how is it now, but also behavioral neurology is not like the main route in neurology. Still not. I mean, you're a little an outsider in the neurological world. So.
And so, meaning you felt different now in analysis that you became, you felt like you were in the center of where you wanted to be?
Actually, I'm saying that I was used to being in the periphery of neurology, right, so, and also it's a little similar experience in the psychoanalytic world, being a little a stranger or something like that. I'm used to this.
We're having something a little different and special, you know, like to bring in.
Let's talk about what that different and special is like. You both have unique training and clinical experiences and unique mindsets as a result of it. You've trained very deeply in the world of neurology and likewise in the world of the mind, both brain and mind. And it would be too easy to say, oh, yes, and they go together perfectly. Because they don't, at least not always. Rachel, why don't you start us? What's it like to have both of those minds? Let's, to simplify it, call it a brain way of thinking and a mind way of thinking. And how you live with both of them in the clinical situation?
Yeah, sure. Let's see. So this is something that I've been working on the whole time, is kind of how to integrate these things, how to make use of the background in a way that's helpful and not distracting or kind of over-intellectualized or something like that. So, for example, I would say that it took some time to not apply. Well, let me start this way. So one of the things that I liked about neurology and was very satisfying was the way that we got to a diagnosis. So maybe you'd start from a symptom or a physical sign, and you would take the history and you would do a physical neurological exam. You would maybe get some radiological studies, etc. And you would start to, like, localize the lesion, they call it,
mm-hmm.
right? You would say, okay, well, this seems to be coming from the right frontal lobe, or this seems to be coming from the cervical spine. This seems to be, you know, this kind of an idea.
Mm-hmm.
And then from there, you'd have a differential diagnosis of things that cause a problem in that area and sort of act like this. And then from there, you would, you know, kind of continue to, like, you know, hone it down pretty quickly, you know, into some kind of answer. And then, only then, you know, what would we do about it if we can do something about it? And it took some time, and I had a few supervisors who helped me with this to sort of, like, use that kind of thinking. Like, there are symptoms, let's say. There are things going on that you're observing with a patient or that the patient is sharing, and you are going to try to put it somewhere in a scaffold, you know, and kind of understand it and get to the bottom of it. But how to keep the possibilities open all at the same time for a while, right? As opposed to honing in quickly on the answer, you know, and sort of not, you know, how you can ask things of your patient and analysis in such a way that opens up, you know, for them to share what's on their mind versus foreclosing possible things they might feel, think, or say, this kind of thing. So that took some time to work on and still comes up sometimes. And then I think the other piece is sometimes patients that know that I was a neurologist from before, either because somebody told them or because they can find it online, let's say. It brings up, I think, pretty frequently somatic symptoms that are neurological in nature.
Actually neurologic or presented for your interest?
Just like, I don't know. I guess I've never compared it with other people. You know, when somebody comes in and, like, let's say, Harvey, how people come in and talk to you about physical symptoms they're having, stomach aches, or I feel like more often than not, they're neurological things, headache, tingling.
Right.
So sometimes I find that I get into this thing where I'm like, am I supposed to be thinking about this from a neurological standpoint and getting it checked out? Or am I supposed to be wondering why this symptom is here and why it's taken this form? And so, you know, I can share the thing that happened before we got on, because it's a good example. If Deb, you don't mind, you had coughed before we started and you had been drinking something. And so, like, part of my mind said, you know, I'm nervous too. Maybe he's nervous. Maybe this cough has to do with being nervous and about speaking or something. And then the other part at the exact same time is like, coughing when drinking. That makes me think of aspiration. Like, I wonder if there's swallowing problems. What kinds of things cause swallowing problems? You know, right. So sometimes those two things can kind of happen all at the same time. There are times where I kind of wish I could shut that part off.
And yet at the same time, you mentioned that it also adds something to your experience of the patient.
It's for both, sure. Right.
Yeah. Before I ask if that is talking about being on the periphery of our field, many of our colleagues either come through psychiatry or come from outside of medicine in a host of backgrounds. You're being able to think both to the advantage and disadvantage, as you said, of, let's say, is he aspirating as one of your reactions would be something that someone, a non-medical person, would not think. As we get to know people's particular journeys to becoming psychoanalysts, one of the things we have to be honest about, just like you were both saying, that one can speak freely and say things. One can also speak freely about the differences between our different backgrounds. And while honoring that they each bring their own advantages, they also bring differences. And it seemed to me this would be a difference, that you would think in this differential diagnosis way differently than a psychologist or a social worker would think. And I'm not making a hierarchy of advantages, but just noticing that there's a difference. And what it's like for you when you feel yourself or hear others thinking and you notice that difference.
Yeah. I suppose I have mixed feelings about it. You know, sometimes when these things come up, I feel, pleased or proud that I have, you know, put a lot of blood, sweat, and tears into medical training and neurological training and have this to kind of bring to the clinical work or to supervision of other people's clinical work, let's say. I think there are times where I've been able to catch something that is a neurological problem that is presenting in a way that doesn't seem like that on the surface. So that feels very satisfying. And so in that way, I think I mostly really like it about myself. There are times there are some complicated things with patients where sometimes I have a wish that it, that I could look at it in without that part.
Mm-hmm. It's getting in the way, you're saying.
Could somebody else think about that part, perhaps? Mm-hmm. And sometimes it plays into like an anxiety, like, I think it's a wish to not have to worry, am I missing something?
That's the worry of all physicians.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, yeah. Iftash, share with us, what's it like for you?
Well, I can, first of all, I can really identify with what Rachel just mentioned, because usually when you're working in private practice and you see patients and you are a physician, you feel obliged at least to think, you don't have to do something, but you have to think whether you should do something. And I had like recently an experience that really made me think about it, and you know how like this dual training is at times very difficult. I saw a patient in my hospital in the ward where I work as her therapist, so it's like twice a week therapeutic session, and really it was, and whenever she, there were like bodily things and issues of medications, I didn't really have to do anything about it. It was like a very peculiar experience, because I know she has a physician in our ward, there is a nurse in our ward. It's really, and I felt, wow, how I want really to have that, like this feeling of being free from having to keep some part of my brain thinking about mm-hmm. it. Although at times I usually don't do anything about it. Now, and in a way I'm divided, because like my hospital now is trying to create something that would, that there is this big notion that I'm part of it, of turning, of becoming a neuropsychiatric center, like transforming our psychiatric division into more of a neuropsychiatric division. We have a new chief, which is really very energetic and charismatic about it. And, you know, I'm part of it. I'm in a department of neuropsychiatric daycare in the division of psychiatry. So I'm really part of this thing, and I think it's important. But at times I feel for myself, wow, you really can't combine the two things together. There is psychiatry and, or neuropsychiatry and psychoanalysis. It's totally different. And, you know, I'm really moving between these two positions.
But in your moving, you're both, as we mentioned earlier, working with your neurologic colleagues to bring to them, tell me if this is a fair characterization, some of the advantages that you've gleaned in your own development and your own training as psychoanalyst. You're trying to bring it back to the world of neurology that you came from in your Balint type interventions. Rachel, tell us what you're doing and how it's received.
Sure. So when I was on the faculty in neurology, one of my roles was co-director of the neurology residency training program. And I loved that. I loved the teaching, the mentorship, you know, just being part of the residence training experience. And it was, you know, probably the hardest part to give up when leaving. Mm-hmm. I had felt so fortunate to have that job as a pretty junior person. And so I did want to stay connected to, I mean, I think in part it started because I wanted to stay connected to the residents. I wanted to stay connected to the Department of Neurology. I do share patients with a lot of my old neurology colleagues. You know, they'll refer patients to me who need, psychotherapy help, let's say. Mm-hmm. But this is sort of another way to stay connected. So what happened was when I opened my practice, I spoke to my old friend who was the co-director with me. I said, how about I run these groups with the residents? And they're kind of like a Balint group, kind of like a support group. It's a bit of a hybrid type thing. Mm-hmm. I do it with a partner from our center who has experience doing group work, because that was not a thing that I had as much experience with. And together we meet with the residents in they're separated by classes. And we meet with them with a given class like every other week, let's say. And in there, it's pretty free form. They're They can talk about whatever is on their minds. And over time, try to steer them to tune into what's happening for them emotionally as neurology residents. There's a lot of very difficult things that you have to face in the inpatient neurology setting. A lot of death, you know, a lot of very upset, angry people, you know, et cetera, et cetera. A lot of helplessness. You know, as they, you know, and I think it's sort of, you asked Harvey about bringing the psychoanalytic background in. I mean, I think we try to tune them into their countertransference a lot of the time and how they can use that in their doctoring as an example.
Which must be revolutionary for them, no?
I mean, nobody talked to me about that back then.
I bet.
You know, but there's, you know, so they may bring up an issue with a colleague or with a upset patient or something like this. And, you know, what is that bringing up for them? And how can they make use of that to deal with the situation? That would be one example of what we try to do to help them in their clinical work, because, you know, it's a lot of those interactions that cause them to feel very burnt out.
Sure. And so it's well received?
Yeah, I think it's been well received. We've been doing it for 7-8 years now. I think they really enjoy having the space to do this. And some of them tell the residency director that part of the reason they chose to do residency at Penn is because they learned on the interview trail that the program offers this thing.
Wow, that's great.
Yeah. That's cool.
Ifta, what's your experience?
Well, I think it's very similar. I've also been doing this for like 8 years already. And I think that it's like, I'm really thankful to the chief of neurology that really enabled this, because it's time consuming. It's during the working hours and they have to free the time. And it's usually I do it with residents that are in the ward. So it's like really very busy time for them, but still they're very, I mean, it's like the very, very difficult time. And it's really like talking, I mean, and actually this is how we defined the group, like talking about transference, counter-transference issues in taking care of neurological patients. And it's, for some of them, it's really exciting. It's very helpful. And it's also part of what I do or did or still do is like that I'm really the in-house psychiatrist in the department. So it really became during the years to a department of neurology where during rounds they can talk about projective identification, transference, repetition, compulsion, whatever. I mean, it's very nice. You know, they don't like say, this is something that belongs to psychiatry. They really try and address issues and look at them. So I think it's important.
It becomes part of their medical mindset and their care. You know, the name of this podcast is Psychoanalysis on and off the couch. And I'm listening to both of you. And it jumps up at me as a wonderful example of that. That you've trained as analysts on the couch, you treat patients as analysts on the couch, but in addition to that, you bring your hard-won, you talk about blood, sweat, and tears of being a neurologist. Well, maybe not as masochistic as that, but there's certainly a long road to becoming a psychoanalyst, and that we've traveled, and we bring that to venues apart from that. I mean, every one of the neurology residents that you each encounter and all the patients that they work with will be affected by what you have done in your mind on your couches, if you will, but just as a psychoanalyst. And it spreads seeds of goodness. I don't mean to sound trite, because I don't feel it to be trite, to the world at large, affecting far more people than we do just by focusing on the individuals we see in our office. And I would love to ask you more and more about this, but we have to wind up. And I want to thank you both. It's been fascinating for me. Rachel, you and I have known each other, but I know you better now because I've heard in more detail your story. And Iftah, it's a pleasure. And one of the reasons I like the idea of talking to analysts from different countries, because we should realize that we are in a group together around the world. Mm-hmm. And there are similarities, there are differences, but we are a collective doing important work and seeding the world with like you said, I can't believe people can talk about these things. Indeed, people can talk about these things, and they and we and our communities are better off for it. So thank you both.
Thank you.
It's been a pleasure.
Thank you, Harvey.
And we hopefully will be able to stay in touch.
Thanks.
Thanks again. Thank you for listening. If I may, I'd like to ask you to help us publicize our podcast by rating us on iTunes or simply sharing it with a friend. You can also visit our webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can both subscribe and also add your comments. I'd also like to acknowledge the lovely rendition of Beethoven's Opus 18th String Quartet by the Allegri String Quartet on the Vivat label.